Hello and welcome. Here's another Take Two from your friends at Take Two. And also,
here's another Take Two from your friends at Take Two.
Also the same people who brought you Take One. And also all the other takes. At the end of Take One, you were talking about ropey CGI.
Yes.
With reference to Bullet Train.
Yes.
It is one of those things that amazes me. There was a case on another movie that we talked about where the CGI on the train, you go, this is poor. This is just not good enough. And you would think with the budgets that some movies get that this was not an insurmountable problem. And there is another thing that has been particularly galling, and TV shows do this all the time, movies do it all the time. You know that standard shot when they're telling a story, when it's people in a car. Mm-hmm. There's someone driving and there's someone next to the person driving, commonly known as the passenger.
Yes, the passenger.
And the person driving always looks to the passenger, taking their eyes off the road, maybe for about 5 seconds. And I'm thinking, watch the road. And it's like the single biggest indicator that this is not a proper scene.
Yeah.
So even with great actors with multi-million pound budgets, they still take their eyes off the road and watch the passenger. And I want you, Mark, to do something about it.
I will do something about it. I'm just looking to see what the budget of Bullet Train. Let me see if there's anyone who says it. Because the ropey CGI, I mean, usually, as we've discussed this before, the people who get get it in the neck of the CG artists who are...
Well, it's like the last Jurassic World movie. The stuff in there should be absolutely tip-top and isn't.
But the reason it isn't is nothing to do with the... Okay, fine. Drama Bullet Train, 86 million. So not a huge amount of money, but I mean, still 86 million.
But the driving in a car sequence is nothing to do with budget at all.
It's just to do with watch
the road.
Yeah, and also, but the other driving in a car thing is that...
Do you want to say what you're doing?
Yeah. So when you drive a car, usually, and you're driving on a road having a conversation with somebody, most of the time your hands barely move. The car is going in a straight line. To all intents and purposes, your hands are on the wheel and the car is going in a straight line.
10 to 2.
Yeah. And, movie car driving, it's... Da, 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 up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. Which, if you translated that to the car, you'd be like the crazy clown car that comes out at the beginning of the circus.
And a cop would pull you over.
A cop would go, excuse me, sir, would you mind blowing into this bag? I said, blow into it.
Also.
That was a good old music hall joke.
Also.
Can you fill this, you remember that thing? Can you fill this jar? Not from here.
Yeah. That's like two runnies, wasn't it?
Something like that. Yeah.
Anyway. Also, when the policeman pulls you over, he could say, you weren't watching the road, you were talking to your passenger, like you're in a movie.
Yeah.
Jane, heritage listener, and now vanguardista. Doctors, just wanted to thank Mark for flagging up She Will.
Oh, good, yeah.
Which I hadn't seen a single advert or trailer for and would hate to have missed. As a fan of both witchy films and Alice Krieger's contributions to genre cinema. I am very much the target audience for She Will.
Good.
And it delivered on both fronts. Yes, it was a bit odd how Rupert Everett appeared to have wandered in from another movie.
Yes.
But I'm not sure a film that has access to Alice Krieger's marvellously expressive face needs her to deliver gothic cliches like, this place feels as if I've been here before. But the atmosphere, the soundtrack, the dream sequences, and most of all, the central relationship between Veronica and Desi really captivated me. Tickety-tonk, down with sneering defenders of the patriarchy, says Jane. I'm not sure who you have in mind there, Jane, but thank you for your greetings.
May I say something on the subject of Alice Krieger? Because when I was younger, obviously, I saw the film adaptation of Ghost Story. Have you ever seen it? The film of Ghost Story?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Do you remember much about it? It has the most astonishing... No. Okay, so the way that the book of Ghost Story, which is Peter Straub, okay, is that it is a story within a story. So there's the modern-day story, and so there's the older... And there's a club that get together to tell stories, and the reason they get together to tell stories is basically because there is a story that they can't tell about something that happened to them when they were younger that they're sort of keeping at bay by telling ghost stories. And the Peter Straub book, which Stephen King sort of described as like the kind of all ghost stories condensed into one, is like that. The film of Ghost Story features in the older cast Fred Astaire, Melvin Douglas, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., John Houseman, Patricia Neal, Alice... I mean, just, you know, it is a fantastic cast. And Alice Krieger plays Eva Garley slash Alma Mobley. It's the dual role. And I think that in that film, she was... So many horror fans of a certain age would just think, yeah, that's, you know, she. It was such a great performance. It was such a brilliant performance. I know she's done a load of other stuff since then, but it was really lovely to see her back in the horror genre. And I've told you the thing that the revisited phrase in Ghost Story, which is one of my favorite things in fiction ever, which is that there is a conversation which is revisited three times, that the guy wakes up in bed and she's looking out of the window and her back is turned and she says something. And the first time she says it, he thinks that she says, "I saw a ghost." And then the second time he realizes that she didn't say, "I saw a ghost." She says, "I am a ghost." And the third time he realizes that she didn't say that. She said, "You are a ghost." And it's the most wow. brilliant piece of writing.
And that's in?
Ghost Story by okay. Peter Straub.
Eric Crawford in Massachusetts. Hello, gents. Hello, Jason. Fellow Vanguardistas. Thank you for singing the praises of the limited series whilst discussing Midnight Mass.
Yeah, good.
As I finished watching Severance last week, oh, such a groan I produced when it hit me that they were giving me merely a season finale rather than an ending. Would love to hear opinions on the perfect limited series. I nominate HBO. We were singing this because in Midnight Mass, it's clearly they told a story. They finished telling the story.
And
they're
that's
not,
it. Yeah.
I mean, apparently.
Yeah, but you'd find it very hard to do yes. season two of Midnight Mass.
I nominate HBO's Watchmen show from 2019. Creator Damon Lindelof.
Lindelof.
It's just it's three syllables, and I was expecting it to be two.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. Yeah.
It could be Lindelof.
I think it's Lindelof.
Okay. Anyway, creator Damon took the characters of the 1980s comic book and created what he called a closed-ended story, set a few decades later. This story centers largely on unfamiliar characters and ties the weft and weight of real-world history to a fantasy timeline. The thematic core is the legacy of racism. Early episodes are intriguing and a touch baffling, whether you're familiar with the Watchmen books and film or not. But from there, the invention and characterizations accelerate and deepen. Regina King, Jean Smart, and Jeremy Irons are tip-top fab. And I'm not sure the superhero genre ever had it so good. And I haven't seen Watchmen, but I like the idea of something where you go, I'm investing in six episodes or however many it is. That'll be it.
What was the phrase? The closed-ended story?
Yes, he called it a closed-ended story.
Or, as we used to call them, stories.
Or series one.
Yeah, I know, but it's terrible, isn't it? It's that thing about now when you actually have to say a closed-ended story as opposed to a story.
Yes.
Because a story used to be a beginning, a middle, and an end, although not necessarily in that order.
Yeah, but yeah,
I love a good ending. I do love a thing that finishes. I mean, that's why I love Angel Heart. That's what, you know, for all the things that are wrong with Angel Heart and the lighty eyes, and everything, it's got a really good ending.
Also, sometimes you can tell when series one was actually going to be the only series, but because it was so successful, they brought it back. So I think Stranger Things could have actually finished quite happily at series one, but because it was so, you know, you got to bring it back, absolutely.
Yeah.
But also in that email from Eric, he was talking about the weft and weight of real world history. And
that's a lovely phrase.
Well, weft is a fantastic, because it's a...
What does weft mean?
Well, weft is a weaving phrase. So I just thought it's probably related to heft, but any weft, the warp and weft, I think the warp thread went vertically and the
weft
goes
like that. Okay.
Weaves in and out
okay.
of the warp. But I think it's very expressive.
Heft is one of my favourite words.
Yes, and when you use it, it's... But in its construction, it makes it feel like an Anglo-Saxon word. But anyway, maybe it is. Eric in Massachusetts, thank you very much. Noel Nestor, gentlemen, greetings from a surprisingly sunny Limerick here in the west of Ireland. I had the pleasure of stumbling across your podcast this week, and whilst I'm glad all the advertising worked, and whilst I haven't had the time to listen to all the episodes, I have four.
Sorry, how did you find out about the podcast? Was it the posters on the side of the bus?
No.
Was it the adverts in other podcasts?
No.
Was it word of mouth?
It was a mistake.
I was looking for something else.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm here now. I have four episodes under my belt. The reason I'm so delighted to hear your podcast is due to an increasing bugbear of mine.
That's a good word as well.
It is, that I would love to hear your opinion on, and that is trailers. Which, I mean, to be honest, we have discussed trailers on a fairly regular basis.
We have.
I have been a huge fan of movies ever since my first trip to the cinema, which, now get this, was to see The Towering Inferno at the age of five.
Have I told you about The Towering Inferno?
You have.
Okay.
But you shouldn't see it when you're five.
Well, you know, back then, The Towering Inferno was an was an A-rated movie, which meant that you had to go with somebody over the age of 16.
Yeah, but if you're five, it's kind of...
No, I know. There's a lot of Inferno in The Towering Inferno.
Maybe it's just me, but I find that I can no longer watch trailers for upcoming movies, as most are about 3 minutes long and practically give away every plot twist and major action sequence,
they do,
leaving very little to the imagination when I do go and see the movie. So I now avoid trailers altogether where possible. What is your opinion on this, as there have been some fantastic teaser trailers, which in my mind are even more of a draw to go and see a movie. For example, last year when The Irishman was being released, and the teaser trailer was a bullet spinning on the screen and a conversation heard in the background asking if you paint houses. Now, while I'm not saying to get rid of trailers altogether, as I used to love them, but maybe just limit them to, I don't know, 60 seconds. I like the idea of a teaser trailer in as well. There's some creativity that's got into it.
Yeah.
I have found your podcast to be the perfect trailer substitute, and most recently I dragged my wife against her will to see Elvis. She isn't a fan, but she loved the movie. And since then, my middle child, 15, went to see it with her friends, albeit partly to drool over Austin Butler. To my amazement, she loved it, and now she and her friends have been trolling through Elvis's back catalogue on Spotify.
Fantastic.
And discovering a whole genre of music that kids of her generation never heard before. 2022, in my opinion, has come up trumps with movies and TV shows, with Everything Everywhere All at Once being possibly my favourite so far, along with Elvis, and we're currently in the middle of Blackbird and recently watched The Black Phone, all based on your recent podcasts. I'm off now to dig out a copy of Bubba Hotep, as Mark mentioned briefly while reviewing Elvis, and I haven't seen it so long, felt I had to watch it again. Thank you for that. Keep up the great work and look forward to your recommendations. So Noel, we're kind of, Noel, we say things here and he goes in Limerick and he watches it there.
Just to say, you can no longer use the phrase comes up Trump's, you don't have to say comes up Biden's.
Coming up roses. Why don't
coming up roses.
Everything is coming up roses.
Everything's that's, coming up roses.
That's fine. Let's do a one frame back,
yes.
Exploring films that are connected in some way to one of this
and
week's
in this releases. Case, the connection is particularly tenuous.
It is, because we're recommending vampire movies.
Because Irma Vep,
which is an anagram of vampire, but it's not really about vampires. In fact, it's not at all
about vampires. Not at all about vampires.
Unless in the final couple of episodes it does something which we're not expecting. We have got some recommendations here from various folk. Research Nick says, I mean, obviously, Let the Right One In, you know, the original, but I suspect the right answer to this particular question is Near Dark. Someone who calls themselves RCB, Stakeland is woefully underrated as a film. Margita Muller, Bram Stoker's Dracula with Gary Oldman. Zeta Short says The Hunger is pretty rad. It's so it's so stylish that you hardly notice that the story doesn't have all that much substance. Adam Farrand, I'll echo everyone else and say Near Dark, but Lost Boys is a real treat, and 30 Days of Night is an underrated pick for me. Anima Goblin chooses Mr. Vampire, The Hopping Kills Me. No, I haven't seen that, so not much of that. Chris Painter, Les Vampires, if that counts, but probably doesn't.
Well, yeah, but that's, yeah.
And Darren Lucas goes for A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, Let the Right One In, Near Dark, and 30 Days of Night.
Wow.
Some of the suggestions from our correspondents. Mark, what is your choice for our one-frame bank?
It's so interesting that 30 Days of Night came up twice. I mean, you know, all these things are personal, and so you know what my choice is. And it's Near Dark because, firstly, because it's great, and secondly, it's Catherine Bigelow, and thirdly, it's, you know, half the cast of Aliens. But because that was the film that the good lady professor, her indoors, and I went to see on our first date, although she says that it wasn't a date, and I said that it was. But you know,
what did she think it was?
She thought it was just going to see a movie with some odd bloke who happened to be there.
That's always a date.
Well, no, apparently not. I mean, because when we first when we met, and I was desperate to impress her, I thought she was fab. She thought I was a pain. So not much has changed. And then I said, oh, you know, let's go to Corner House and see a film. Oh, okay, what for what? So we'd go and see Near Dark. It's a new Catherine Bigelow movie. That'd be brilliant, blah, 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 blah. So she went, okay. So met her at Corner House, went in, saw Near Dark. You know, it's great. It all went really well. That was that. Now, I thought
that's
that... Right. Yeah, well, except that kind of, you know, the next time we went out was about 4 years later.
Oh.
But then she said that we hadn't gone out, you see. She said that it wasn't a date. It was just that we went to the cinema, we watched a Catherine Bigelow movie. So that was so it just it holds a slightly different significance in our lives.
You should have made it slightly clearer then.
I thought it was clear. I said, would you like to come and see a vampire movie with me? Which is really the equivalent of, would you like to spend the rest of your life with me? Isn't it? Isn't it? That's what Paul Verhoeven says, isn't it?
I think... Probably
what
not.
Was the first movie you and the good lady Ceramicus saw?
It was a Charles Bronson film.
Wow. Yeah, oh, was it? It wasn't Death Wish 2.
Yes, it was.
You've told me. What a terrible choice.
It was just
what
on.
What a terrible choice.
It was just on.
Wow.
I had.
Wow. Of all the Death Wish movies, that's the worst one.
ABC, it was the ABC cinema
it's
in Nottingham.
So offensive.
I know. But, you know, it doesn't really matter what the film is, does it, really? Anyway.
Wow. Now, Death Wish 2. How long have you been married?
That was our first date, so we hadn't...
No, how long have you been married?
Oh,
not had you been married.
65 years.
65 years, that's great.
Years,
well,
which is quite extraordinary.
Do you ever talk about that first movie date?
Are you going to tell us what your...
Near Dark.
That's it. I thought we were going to go somewhere else.
No.
Okay.
And I love Let the Right One In and I love 30 Days.
Where can I watch that?
Oh, it's available everywhere. Available on Widely.
On Widely. Widely.
Have you got Widely?
It's £9.99 on top of a £10.99 yearly subscription.
Yeah.
Which is on top of another 50 quid, which I have to pay every quarter.
Exactly. But it is. It's a great service.
Okay, so we are open for your suggestions about what we should be watching and just general correspondence, which goes to correspondence@codenomeo.com. We are going to have some more Alicia Vikander because you are part of the Vanguard, because you deserve extra treats. When we spoke to Alicia Vikander for Irma Vep, we thought we'd do some extra correspondence and extra conversation to go into this part for you. So you just get a little bit more Alicia. So here we go. Just before we leave Irma Vep altogether, it was when you've been describing this, Alicia, and its origins in 1915 and the nods back to the previous film and the previous series, it's almost as though we've got a history of female film stardom from the earliest days of cinema to now, all in this show.
If it's anything, I think it's very much an homage to filmmaking. And then an homage to maybe the beginning, at least, of these female characters that finally, you know, got to get on screen and not only be noticed, but really kind of make a huge mark in history. And something that I think, you know, changed the world of cinema and characters from then until now.
Can I ask you something about languages? When I first met you, when Royal Affair was out, and I remember you saying that you had learnt a language for the film, and I had just assumed that you were speaking in your native tongue. How many languages do you speak?
I was actually at a wedding of the Danish director of that film just a few weeks ago, and it was nice to then go back and notice that my Danish is still okay after quite a few years. But, I mean, that was still a jump, which wasn't that far, obviously, because those languages are somewhat, you know, related. And then English. I wish I could say a lot more, but maybe in the future.
But it's an amazing facility with languages. I speak one, Simon, one and a half.
I'm trying to learn Danish, Alicia. I have...
Oh, you are? Amazing.
Yes, well...
We can snack desk, Simon.
Well, no. I now have a Danish grandson from about a month ago. And so I'm thinking I need to be able to speak something other than saying Tusind Tak all the time.
Yeah, and it's a lot of amazing Danish films to then go back and watch in original language.
Yeah, anyway, but I'm failing. Danish is a very complex. I've got a couple of listener questions here. Eliza says, in Irma Vep, is Mira, your character, Also an anagram.
It is.
Scared of her sexuality.
I don't think she's scared of her sexuality. I just think she's in a place where she's confused, which I think goes for a lot of things at the moment in her life. I think she is, not only when it comes to the love aspect of her life, but when we meet her in the series, she's kind of making a transition of, I think she's been listening to a lot of voices in her life of what she should do and what paths she should go, what paths to take, maybe who to be with. And finally, she's, you know, realized that she needs to find her own voice, and to be happy or to feel content, she needs to listen to herself. And I think in that transition where she is right now, she's been probably looking for love or intimacy, because I think the world as an actor, or where she's been, has been quite lonely. She's just jumping from cities and work all the time. And I think hopefully by the end of this series, she'll be able to kind of face and be true to herself.
What are your own favorite roles? I mean, obviously you've appeared in everything from Lara Croft to, you know, recently The Green Knight, which I thought was superb. What are the roles that you yourself are most proud of?
It's interesting, just the two you mentioned. I love, which I got to do in this series as well. I mean, I know I have my background as a dancer, but I do love characters when I get to like physically really kind of inhabit them. Ex Machina was one of them. In Green Knight, I got the chance to do that as well, because it was two very distinctly different parts in one film. And Lara Croft was one too, actually. I had always kind of looked up to big action films and wondered what that would be like to get to do all those stunts. And I very much enjoy that too. So,
are dance and action very similar? Is the choreography of dancing and doing action movies the same?
I mean, the same. I mean, yes, it's very similar, because like you said, you need to learn choreography, especially for things to be safe, I would say. You know, and you end up doing everything like exactly the same over and over again to make sure that no one is making any mistakes. So in that sense, yeah, it is. And dance is as much to kind of to be an extension of an emotion, I found, at least when I was dancing. So it's still a way of telling, it's storytelling, even though you don't use words. And I think it can go as far as, if you do a really good action scene, it should do the same. The physicality of it should be telling a story and not just be like, cool moves.
Alicia, it's been great to speak to you again. Part of me was slightly worried about doing this interview.
Why?
Well, because in Irma Vep, you're doing promotion for some tacky science fiction film right at the very beginning, and you do these round table.
Yeah, it's so funny. You're actually not the first one saying that. I think it's been maybe at least five journalists who said that because of that scene. So.
Yeah, well, because also in this science fiction film, you've cut off the testicles of your nemesis. And then someone asks you whether you can apply that to the global political scene. So, which is obviously one of those kind of dumbass questions that you get asked all the time. So I'm glad that we've got that's not the way you've conducted this interview. Having said that, what do you think this series tells us about the European political scene?
Yeah, no.
It's a joke, this, yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this is when we pick up the phone and call Olivier, because it's amazing when he gets any question like that. Then he just starts to talk about like magic or ghosts or anything like that in interviews.
Can I ask you a final dumbass question, which is on the subject of dancing?
Yes.
How much did you enjoy dancing to what I believe is called 99 Luftballon, but over here we call 99 Red Balloons, which is one of my favorite scenes?
I very much enjoyed it because, you know, even though I don't take any classes anymore, actually, when, I mean, Olivier, in a way, made me go back. And the choreographer, I must say, in this series is one of the world's best. And I don't think anyone on set knew. And I was like so nervous because I don't know how I ended up being able to take this back door as an actress and end up dancing with this man. But so I did one of my first lessons, but I haven't done that in like 15 years, but I still love a boogie. So I love that scene too.
Alicia Vikander, a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much indeed for spending some time with us today.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Alicia. I hope you find the little statue of Mark somewhere in the closet.
I will let you know if I find it in my boxes.
On the mantelpiece, please. On the mantelpiece. Thank you.
For sure. Thank you. Bye.
We should say that although this is an audio podcast,
yes, obviously.
We could see Alicia because she was, as she said at the beginning of the interview, she was in France.
And
she wasn't sure about the vision thing because it was early in the morning and she hadn't been told. Or that kind of stuff. Anyway, then she appears on screen looking like $1 million. Looking like I don't know if she did have any makeup on, but she just looked incredible.
I think she was in the bathroom, wasn't she? Because she needed to be somewhere which was quiet. So she was in the harsh light of the bathroom with
you and know, on an iPhone. Yeah. And no one looks great on an iPhone apart from
Alicia Vikander.
Alicia Vikander.
And also, can I just say that when you know,
is this going to be about your award?
Tangentially.
Go on.
So, which you said, I hope you find it. Yeah. Well, when she said, when you asked her that question about that thing, she said, yeah, I've been asked that by 100 journalists. And I asked her a question about dancing. She hadn't been asked that before.
Right.
I liked her first. You see, the Royal Affair thing, I'm sorry, that was it. I was there. And I'm so rarely right. I am so rarely right. If you look at my history of going, this person is going to be a star, it's terrible. I mean, usually if I say somebody's going to be a really successful filmmaker, somebody's going to be a real star, that's it. You can write their career off. You will bump into them in an insurance office very, very soon. In the case of Alicia Vikander, gave her an award. Very, as she said herself, I don't think I'd even done any other interviews in English before that. And then look at the stellar route that her career took.
Entirely down to you.
Entirely down to me. In the same way that Paul Greengrass's entire success is down to the
fact. He always says that.
He always says it, that when Resurrected came out, it had a quote from my review on the poster.
Fine. Any other points you want to make?
No, I'm just, you know, yes, there is another point I'd like to make.
Okay.
It's necessary to celebrate little victories.
Yes.
And that's what I'm doing.
Did you know that Naina,
99 Luftballon,
whose real name, Gabrielle Suzanne Kerner, is actually the most successful solo female German pop singer of all time?
No, I didn't know that. On the basis of 99 Red Balloons.
Well, that and other songs in German.
Okay. You also mentioned, and I ask you this because you are Dr. Pop, you said that apparently she doesn't like the English translation of 99
Luftballon. I can't remember what it is, but she likes the original. I think 99 Luftballon sounds better than 99.
Yeah, and that's what they dance to in Irma Vec.
Yeah, the German version. Yes, yeah. There is something about the English translation. Because, of course, 99 Luftballon doesn't mean 99 Red Balloons.
It means 99 Balloons.
So, yes, there's something more explicitly anti-nuclear weapons about the original, which got lost in the English translation. I think that's right.
Does the original include the German version of the worst line in pop music history, to worry, worry, super scurry?
I don't know, actually, because my German is not. But I'll check that out, Auf Deutsch. And
worry, worry, super scurry, call the troops out in a hurry. This is it, boys. This is war. This is what we waited for. The president is on the line. As 99 red balloons go by.
Hmm.
And everyone's a Captain Kirk at one point, isn't it?
Yeah, something about a jet fighter. Anyway, to be honest, it was the overall sound picture, I believe, that she was painting.
She was painting a picture with words and sound.
And it was exotic and foreign and Germanic.
Reminds me of Joyce Grenfell. And what do we paint? What's it? Is that a big orange sun? Oh, it's Mummy. Are we going to give Mummy a nose?
No.
No nose.
You have to stop blowing at Edgar.
Yes.
Anyway, yeah, that's a very old reference.
I'm sorry. But
anyway, thank you very much, Deed, for subscribing. You're probably now thinking, if you're going to start quoting Joyce Grenfell, we might be back after a short break. Next week, Rufus Jones and Anna Bogotskaya will hold the fort. For now, we bid you farewell as we set off on our fabulous cruise.
George,
don't do that.